Hello, rioters. Before we get started, a quick disclaimer. If you're listening to this episode with small children, I recommend that you don't. Some of the subject matter is probably not suitable for young ears, though I am not a parent, I am not the parent of your children, and I cannot tell you what is suitable for your children. But I do want to go ahead and make a trigger warning here at the beginning, a pre-beginning of the episode to let you know that some of the subject matter today is going to be sensitive, and if you cannot hear about issues of child molestation, rape, sex abuse, then today's episode is probably going to not be an episode you want to listen to, or at least listen to in a space with people who can help support you during it. Also, just FYI, if you're used to fairly squeaky clean language from me, this is not the episode for you. Oh.
Grab your pitchfork, light your torch, and get ready for inciting a riot. Conventional thinking has been warned, because we're going to gather, and we're going to march, and we're going to blow its f***ing house down.
Hello, rioters, and welcome back to episode 109 of Inciting a Riot, the podcast. I would be your left-wing dirt-worshipping host, Firelight. Today's episode has been a few months in the making. As you can probably tell, it has been a while since we have rioted. The main reason for that isn't because I didn't want to create an episode. It's because the incidents that I wanted to discuss were so rapidly changing that I didn't feel that any one episode could possibly have anything productive to add to a discussion, because the news, the current events, the issues surrounding what I wanted to discuss were changing so rapidly, developing so quickly, that what we thought we knew, we didn't know, and here we are 5 months into the year, and this is only the second episode, I think, of 2017. But it was my husband who told me, listen, just talk. People want to hear what you have to say and hear your take on things. So it doesn't matter if the news is changing. The news is always going to change. Don't be afraid of that and speak up. So that's what I'm doing. So today we are inciting a protest riot, and that should make sense given some of the things that have happened in the world in the last few months. All of the things that have happened in the world the last few months. Today we're going to be discussing religious protest, spiritual protest, and ideas around that. We're also going to be talking about some pretty sticky issues, things that have come up this past week even, things that have been coming up in almost a cyclical problematic reality for months, years, and we're going to be talking about those today. We're going to be talking about some race issues, we're going to be talking about ally issues, we're going to be talking about protest issues. We are also going to be talking today about developing issues regarding big name pagans and bad behavior, and whether or not we as a community plan on allowing those to continue. But before we can get to spiritual protest, before we can discuss big name pagans and bad behavior, before we can talk about problematic allies, we have to get straight to those news headlines.
Inciting a newsworthy riot.
In April, Judge Neil Gorsuch was named to the United States Supreme Court because of what is known as the nuclear option. And I felt that we should go ahead and lead off today with a topic that I wanted to discuss. A couple of months ago. But as like I said earlier, issues kept developing. The news around it was developing so quickly. I never felt that the issue was at a point where we could riot about it. But Senate Republicans in early April engineered a pretty dramatic change in how the chamber confirms Supreme Court nominees. They bypassed a Democratic blockade of Judge Neil Gorsuch in a move that's going to shape how the Senate and the court look for years, for generations to come. After Democrats filibustered President Trump's nominee, Republicans voted to lower the threshold for advancing Supreme Court nominations from 60 votes to a simple majority. In deploying this so-called nuclear option, lawmakers are fundamentally altering the way the Senate handles one of its most significant duties, further limiting the minority's power in a chamber that was designed to be a slower and more deliberative body than the House. In fact, the United States Senate is considered by many to be the most deliberate governing body in the world. It's slow. It is methodical. It is allegedly supposed to take its time to consider what is best for the country, which is why a lot of senators do a lot of grandstanding, because they think that they're, you know, so ethereal, so up there, so intellectual. The move, which was once unthinkable among senators, is a testament to the creeping partisan rancor in recent years. After decades of at least relative bipartisanship on Supreme Court matters, both parties have warned of sweeping effects on the court itself, predicting the elevation of more ideologically extreme judges now that only a majority is required for confirmation. So a little history here. You may have seen on the news or your racist aunt's Facebook that, Democrats also enacted the nuclear option a few years ago. And that's true to an extent. Senate Democrats in 2013 first changed the rules of the Senate to block Republicans' filibusters of presidential nominees to lower courts and to government positions, but they specifically left the filibuster for Supreme Court nominees untouched, which was an acknowledgement of the court's exalted status. However, last month, that last pillar was swept away on a party-line vote, with all 52 Republicans choosing to overrule Senate precedent, and all 48 Democrats and liberal-leaning independents pushing to keep it. Democrats lay the blame for this occurring on Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky. He's the majority leader, and his Republican colleagues, who last year refused to even consider Judge Merrick Garland, President Barack Obama's nominee for the seat of Justice Antonin Scalia, who died 15 months ago at this point. Senator Chuck Schumer of New York, the Democratic leader, said, quote, "When history weighs what happened, the responsibility for changing the rules will fall on the Republicans and Leader McConnell's shoulders." Here's why this is a big deal. So in the past, whenever presidents have nominated somebody like a Supreme Court justice to the court, they've had to consider what is going to meet the needs of the many, what is going to create who they can appoint that is going to create the biggest amount of compromise between the left and the right in order to agree upon one person's viewpoints and charge them with the responsibility of leading this nation for generations to come, at least legally. The Supreme Court of the United States is sort of the ultimate word of the rule of law in our country. You know, we have them to thank for things like marriage equality, for interracial marriage equality, for a host of civil and criminal liberties that we take for granted at this point, that would not have gotten through the legislature, that did not get through the legislature, but were fought and won in the courts. And so the Supreme Court is very important. Now, what is being forgotten in a lot of this conversation is the fact that the justice that was being replaced, Antonin Scalia, is probably one of the most conservative justices to have ever sat on the court. He possibly could be attributed to single-handedly holding back marriage equality for years, as well as many, many, many other kinds of civil rights, you know, that could have been enjoyed by minorities of all types. But, you know, the opportunity last year to appoint a more moderate justice in the person of Merrick Garland was squandered by partisan politics, by the fact that Republicans simply would not allow a vote. And this has now paved the way for the fact that, especially now that this nuclear option has been enacted, the fact that instead of needing a majority of 60 votes to bust a filibuster, now you only need a simple majority to push forward a Supreme Court candidate, and thereby only need a simple majority to vote in a Supreme Court candidate. By doing this, the president, if he has a favorable Congress, if his party is in power, he doesn't have to take into account the views, the minds, the wishes, the wills of the people of the opposite party. If a Democrat is in office and he has a 51-52% majority, he doesn't really need to consider the needs of the Republicans. And I have a problem with that. I think that the people that sit on the highest court in the land should be people that, at the end of the day, can be believed in by people of all political backgrounds. That we can look to members of that court and believe that they have our best interests at heart. But now, going forward, we don't have to do that anymore. Presidents don't have to worry, because all they need to do is overcome the filibuster, and now they can do that with a simple majority thanks to the nuclear option. This is important because more and more presidents, and Donald Trump may still have more Supreme Court seats to fill as his years of tenure go on. And if he's impeached and removed, another Republican is going to take his place. And that person is also going to appoint extremely conservative justices and swing the highest court in the land from a more moderate court, from a right-of-center court, to an extremely right court. And that's a problem. It is a problem whenever we cannot look for a moderate, sane voice of reason at the highest court in the land, because the president doesn't have to take opposing views into account. They do not have to worry about putting forward somebody that a minority will oppose, because it doesn't matter if they oppose them. It doesn't matter if their voice of opposition is loud or even has merit. The president can simply overcome them with a simple majority, and that is a problem. Something else that is a problem is Chechnya's anti-gay program. At the beginning of April, reports surfaced that a crackdown on gay men was afoot in Chechnya, a small, turbulent republic on the southern edge of the Russian Federation. According to the independent Russian newspaper Novaya Gazeta, more than 100 gay men were rounded up by the police and brutalized in secret prisons, and at least 3 of them were killed. Many remain in detention. 75 people called in to the Russian LGBT network's Chechnya hotline, and of these, 52 said they had been victims of the recent violence. 30 fled to Moscow, where they received help from LGBT activists. One survivor told a New York Times reporter, quote, "Once they bring you there, they immediately start the beatings and electrocutions, demanding information about who you were dating." The guards, he said, would spit in the prisoners' faces, and worse, quote, "We were such hated creatures that each guard felt obliged to hit us when passing by." This persecution of LGBTQ citizens is symptomatic of the repressive regime that now runs Chechnya. Their autocratic leader, Ramzan Kadyrov, has enjoyed nearly unconditional support from Russian President Vladimir Putin. It is said in that same aforementioned New York Times article that collective punishment is the hallmark of Mr. Kadyrov's repression. Relatives of those who displease the authorities are threatened, beaten, held hostage, expelled from the republic, or have their homes burned down. These very same techniques have now been applied to the families of men thought to be gay, which are threatened with detention unless the suspects turn themselves into the police. Mr. Kadyrov boasted on Chechen TV in 2013, quote, "If somebody does not obey my orders in this republic, I'll force him." In a more recent article from The Independent, Chechen leader Ramzan Kadyrov has specifically stated that no gay people exist in the Russian Republic, and those who are LGBT are fake Chechens. Kadyrov went on to say, quote, "We have never had them among the Chechens, unless we are talking about those who aren't Chechens, but say they are so that they can get to the West. Chechen society does not have this phenomenon called non-traditional sexual orientation. For thousands of years, the people have lived by other rules prescribed by God. He further claimed that Chechen authorities had not received any official reports of the systematic persecution of gay people in the conservative and chiefly Muslim region. A spokesperson for Mr. Kadyrov previously suggested the allegations were, quote, absolute lies and disinformation, claiming gay people did not exist in the republic. He said, quote, you cannot detain and persecute people who simply do not exist in the republic. If there were such people in Chechnya, the law enforcement organs wouldn't need to have anything to do with them because their relatives would send them somewhere from which there is no returning. He's talking about honor killings. It's been stated in numerous reports that honor killings have begun in Chechnya and that some are dead. At least one person is known to have died from one such honor killing where his own father took him out into the woods and killed him for being gay, for being suspected of being gay. At this time, you might be asking yourself, what is it that I can do? Well, if you lived in a country like Germany, you could count on German Chancellor Angela Merkel to call out folks like Vladimir Putin and Kadyrov publicly and loudly. You could count on your leaders to represent you on the world stage. What we have is a UK ambassador who made some lip service about the matter and has been pretty silent on it since. What can you do? Give to charities that are specifically fighting these issues overseas. Give to the Human Rights Campaign. Give to the American Civil Liberties Union. Fight for the rights of people abroad, but fight for the rights of people here, because if you do not think that something like this could happen here, you need to wake up, because this past year has been a year of we didn't think this could happen here. In a bit of good news, the Marine Corps has made spreading revenge porn grounds for separation. An update to the Marine Corps Separation and Retirement Manual. According to Teen Vogue, which is leading the freaking revolution, and if you are not reading Teen Vogue, please, for the love of God, start. The Marine Corps Separation and Retirement Manual has officially prohibited revenge porn in the military branch, with violators of the new rule subject to being separated from the Corps. Basically, that means they could get kicked out. The rule goes into effect immediately, which means revenge porn is effectively banned from the Marine Corps as of this past month. This new rule comes less than a month after the Navy made a similar change to their guidelines, adding a clause to the U.S. Navy regulations that specifically bans distributing intimate images of someone without their consent. Both are thought to be responses to the violation of privacy of many female Marines discovered back in March when it was revealed that hundreds of Marines were part of a Facebook group filled with nude photographs of female service members and veterans, none of whom appear to have given consent for their photos to be distributed. Veteran Kyle Ann Hunter, who served as a United States Marine officer for 10 years, told Teen Vogue that she sees the action as, quote, an important first step that shows that the Marine Corps is taking revenge porn seriously and not falling into the trap of victim blaming. But she notes that the proof of its effectiveness will be in its execution, the actual separation of Marines. She's further quoted, if Marines start getting separated for sharing nude photos, it may begin to change the culture around misogyny. But there's another reason to be worried about the rule's effectiveness, rankings, in a field where rankings really matter. Marine leadership would still be the ones deciding who gets kicked out. Quote, it still relies on Marines going to their chain of command. Many young female Marines will likely feel uncomfortable engaging with their leadership because they have to admit that they took nude photos to begin with. This is an important step for justice for people that are fighting for our country but are still seen as second-class soldiers because of their gender. Women all over this country, all over the world, are victims of sexual assault, victims of revenge porn at a much higher rate than their male counterparts. But it's swept under the rug. It's seen as locker room talk. It's seen as a joke. It's seen as nothing serious. It's systemic. It's endemic. It's part of our culture. And I'm so glad to see that this step has been taken, but I'm hoping that we are going to see more than just a news report about this getting put on paper. I hope that we see this get put into practice. You may have been hearing on the news that Arkansas is on a deadline. Arkansas is a state here in the United States that has some lethal injection drugs that are about to expire. Arkansas, however, is suffering some setbacks in the courts where judges are saying, no, we're not going to let you all of a sudden carry out all of these executions all of a sudden just because your drugs are about to expire. Arkansas has suffered two more setbacks in its unprecedented bid to carry out 8 executions in April, with the state's highest court granting a reprieve to an inmate scheduled to die and a county court saying the state can't use one of its lethal injection drugs in any executions. While both of those rulings could be overturned, Arkansas now faces an uphill battle to execute any inmates before the end of April when another of its drugs expires. The state originally set 8 executions to occur over an 11-day period this past April, which would have been the most by a state in such a compressed period since the U.S. Supreme Court reinstated the death penalty in 1976. But Arkansas has faced a wave of legal challenges, and the latest ruling from Pulaski County Court Judge Alice Gray over the drug vecuronium bromide upends the entire schedule. Gray sided with McKesson Corp, which had argued that it sold Arkansas the drug for medical use, not executions, and that it would suffer harm financially and to its reputation if the executions were carried out. Gray further stated, quote, irreparable harm will result, harm that could not be addressed by monetary damages. Judd Deer, a spokesman for Arkansas Attorney General Leslie Rutledge, said the state will appeal Gray's ruling. Governor Asa Hutchinson expressed frustration with the repeated legal hurdles, and in a statement, Hutchinson said, quote, I know the families of the victims are anxious for a clear-cut explanation from the majority as to how they came to this conclusion and how there appears to be no end to the court's review. 4 of the 8 inmates have received stays on unrelated issues. If Gray's ruling is vacated by the Arkansas Supreme Court or the state obtains a different supply of vecuronium bromide, say that 10 times fast, the executions of 4 other inmates who haven't received individual stays could potentially go forward. Arkansas Department of Corrections spokesman Solomon Graves said that the state had not obtained a new supply of the drug, which is the 2nd of 3 drugs used in Arkansas's lethal injection protocol. A few days after that report was written this past April, Liddell Lee was executed. He was one of the 8 individuals set for execution in Arkansas's would-be lethal injection spree. Liddell Lee, who was 51, was sentenced to death in 1995 for the killing of Deborah Reese, who was beaten to death in her home 2 years earlier. According to court petitions and his attorneys, Lee has long since denied involvement in Reese's death, and he was seeking DNA testing to try and prove his innocence. Lee's execution was confirmed by state officials. Court stays the night of pushed the execution to the final minutes before the death warrant expired. Lee's time of death was 11:56 p.m. local time, according to the Arkansas Department of Corrections. The execution took 12 minutes, during which Lee showed no apparent signs of suffering, according to the Associated Press, which had a reporter serve as a media witness. The execution warrant for Lee, the 7th person executed in the United States this year, would have expired 4 minutes after he was pronounced dead. I would like it noted that in 2014, a study came out by the University of Michigan that stated that more than 4% of inmates sentenced to death in the United States are innocent. What researchers call a conservative estimate about the number of wrongfully convicted death row inmates is more than double the percentage of capital defendants who were exonerated during more than 3 decades that were studied. That means innocent people are behind bars. According to Samuel Gross, the lead author of the study, he said, quote, "The great majority of innocent people who are sentenced to death are never identified and freed. The purpose of our study is to account for the innocent defendants who are not exonerated." The authors, the 4 of them, of the study, reviewed the outcomes of 7,482 death sentences handed down between 1973 and 2004. Of that group, 117, or 1.6%, were exonerated. But with enough time and resources, the authors concluded that at least 4.1% of death row inmates would have been exonerated. In other words, more than 200 other prisoners would have been cleared during those 3 decades. 200 people that were wrongfully convicted of a crime they never committed. They arrived at that number using survival analysis, a statistics tool commonly used in medicine to evaluate the effectiveness of new treatments. The thing is, as technology improves, we have more and more ways of proving somebody's innocence. DNA in the 90s, in the O.J. Simpson trial, was a revelation in criminal procedure. being able to prove whether or not somebody was actually physically involved in the crime, according to DNA evidence, is a big deal. And so many people that have been languishing on death row for years, decades even, were never given this as an option, which sounds like was the case of Liddell Lee. Now, I'm not sitting here saying whether Liddell Lee was an innocent man or not. I'm saying that he wanted DNA evidence to review his case. He thought that he had a shot, and now he will never have that shot again. The death penalty is a permanent punishment. And we cannot, in this rioter's opinion, go on an execution spree just because our drugs are about to expire. I think it's that important to note the dismissal of James Comey, though this story is going to continue to be a developing issue, and I'm sure that we'll cover it in depth throughout the year, throughout the following years. But to very quickly surmise what has happened so far, on May 9th of this year, President Trump fired FBI Director James Comey. The White House initially said the firing was on the recommendation of United States Attorney General Jeff Sessions and Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein. It should be noted that the FBI director was leading an investigation into Donald Trump and the intersection between him and his campaign and ties to Russia, which was proven to have been a negative influential factor in the election. Jeff Sessions, the United States Attorney General, has had to recuse himself from that investigation because of conflict of interest. And now that same person that's had to recuse himself from the investigation called for the firing of the person leading the investigation. Also, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein sent a memo to Sessions forwarded to Trump in which Rosenstein listed objections to Comey's conduct in the investigation into Hillary Clinton's email. This allowed the Trump administration to attribute Comey's firing to Rosenstein's recommendation about the Clinton email controversy, which got Trump elected. It was later revealed on May 8th that Trump had requested Sessions and Rosenstein to detail in writing a case against Comey. Rosenstein's memo was forwarded to Trump on May 9th and was construed as a recommendation to dismiss Comey, which Trump immediately did. In his termination letter, he attributed the firing to the two letters from Sessions and Rosenstein, despite, again, the fact that he asked them to write them. The Washington Post reported that Rosenstein threatened to resign over the White House's attribution of Comey's dismissal to his memo, which Rosenstein has denied. On May 10th, Trump told reporters he had fired Comey because he wasn't doing a good job. On May 11th, President Trump told Lester Holt in an NBC News interview that Comey was, quote, a showboat and grandstander, that his dismissal was my decision, and, quote, I was going to fire regardless of recommendation, directly contradicting the earlier statements by the White House and Vice President Mike Pence. According to reports, Trump had been openly talking to aides about firing Comey for at least a week before his dismissal. Trump had long questioned Comey's loyalty and judgment. Moreover, Trump was angry that Comey would not support his claim that President Barack Obama had his campaign offices wiretapped, and was frustrated when Comey revealed in Senate testimony the breadth of the counterintelligence investigation into Russia's efforts to sway the 2016 U.S. presidential election. He felt Comey was giving too much attention to the Russia probe and not enough to internal leaks to the press from within the government. Shortly before Comey was fired, he had requested money and resources to further expand the probe into Russian interference into the presidential election. He requested that from, guess who, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, who then said that he should be fired. Isn't all of this interesting and convenient? In the dismissal letter, Trump wrote that Comey had told Trump on three separate occasions that I am not under investigation. Fact checkers reported that while they have no way of knowing what Comey may have told Trump privately, no such assertion is on public record. Trump later specified the three occasions were a private White House dinner and two telephone calls, which Trump also then later stated that he hopes that there are no tapes of those phone calls, which would be interesting since it would reveal that Donald Trump is recording his phone conversations, and that's illegal. FBI Director Comey first learned of his termination from television news reports that flashed on screen while he was delivering a speech to agents at the LA field office. Listen, I am no fan of FBI director James Comey. I think that he showed incredibly poor judgment this past year. And I think that he can be directly attributed as one of the people that gave us Donald Trump. However, it now appears that anybody who investigates Trump gets fired from their job. So I don't know who is supposed to keep the president in check if they cannot be allowed to investigate without fear of retribution and retaliation on the part of the president. We are going to finally take a break from these news headlines and get a little bit smarter with the word of the day.
Inciting a verbal riot.
Today's word is vaticination. It is a noun meaning something foretold or prediction or the act of prophesying. From a Huffington Post article dated December 5th, 2016 by J.H. McKenna, quote, "In fact, origin stories are not about the past at all. They are not eyewitness reportage. They are not history. They are not diary entries detailing actual bygone events. Similarly, end time stories are not about the future at all. They are not predictions. They are not vaticinations. They are not crystal ball visions. The stories are fictive efforts offered as instructions for the present moment." Or from The Economist in June of 2006, quote, "Imagined futures that are really thinly disguised commentaries on current affairs are not chiefly concerned with reliable prediction. Yet look in the periphery of such allegorical tales and you can find some surprisingly accurate vaticination." Did you know? When George Orwell's novel 1984 was published in 1949, a displeased critic said it broke all records for gloomy vaticination. In Orwell's favor, another critic asserted, quote, "It is impossible to put the book down." While it's about as difficult to predict the future of a word as the future of the world, hindsight reveals that vaticination has endured better than other words based on Latin vatis, meaning prophet. Vaticinian, which means prophetic, or vaticinar, which means prophet, and vaticinatress, which means prophetess, and vaticiny, meaning prophecy, have all faded into obscurity. Although two synonyms of prophetic, which are vatic and vaticinal, also keep the vatis lineage alive today.
Inciting a social riot.
Today I'd like to talk about our community, our pagan community, and the leaders that we support, no matter what. No matter what they do, no matter what they say, no matter what crimes they're convicted of, our community still seems to support them. I want to talk about this today in the specific because of the recent sentencing of Kenny Klein. Kenny Klein has been on this show now many times over the last several years, ever since he was brought into custody for allegations of child pornography. Kenny Klein, a New Orleans Wiccan priest, a high mugwump in the fairy tradition, and folk singer, was convicted this past month on 20 counts of child pornography charges, and he was recently sentenced to serve 20 years in prison. Criminal District Judge Byron Williams imposed the sentence after first denying Klein's motion for a new trial. The judge said he had never before received so many letters in support of and opposed to leniency for a defendant before a sentencing decision. Williams said, quote, "Your partner talks about your kindness, and others say you don't pose a threat to society. But just as many have negative things to say about you, calling you an objectionable human being, and a lot of people contend you are a monster. Healing and redemption are available to you right now, but will have to begin in the custody of the Department of Corrections. The unsuspecting victims of child pornography also must be able to heal." Klein, who is now 62, was found guilty on April 6th on one count of child pornography involving a juvenile under the age of 13, and 19 counts of possession with intent to distribute pornography involving juveniles under the age of 17. He faced 10 to 40 years in prison on the first count and 5 to 20 years on each of the other 19 counts. Williams imposed a 20-year sentence on the more severe count and 5-year sentences on each of the remaining 19 counts. The judge ordered all the sentences be served concurrently, which means at the same time. So it's not 20 years and then 5 and then 5 and then 5. He also fined Klein $2,500 and ordered that upon release he wear an electronic ankle monitor for the rest of his life. Quote, the court notes that you are a renowned artist, teacher, and leader, a high priest in the Wiccan community, and there are a number of people concerned because of your age and health. Klein was originally arrested 3 years ago, in March of 2014, after a Louisiana State Police raid on his Lower Garden District apartment uncovered a laptop computer containing 20 videos depicting children engaged in sexually explicit activities that were being shared on a peer-to-peer network. A jury deliberated just over 3 hours before convicting Klein on all counts by an 11-1 vote. The judge denied a post-conviction judgment of acquittal requested by Klein's defense attorney, Bradley Phillips. Phillips said Klein will appeal his conviction with new representation. Klein's motion for a new trial argued that Williams erred in two pretrial rulings and with decisions made during his three-day trial last month. Jurors were allowed to hear testimony from two adults who said they were sexually abused and made to sexually abuse each other while they were children, sometimes under Klein's care, more than 25 years ago. Klein also argued that the court erred in a ruling last September 6th when Williams barred the defense from introducing evidence of alleged crimes or wrongdoing by, quote, several police officers involved in the case. And Klein said that during his trial, Williams wrongly sustained objections by prosecutors Zach Popovich and Arthur Mitchell that prevented his lawyers from providing jurors the entire picture of their theories regarding alternate suspects and motives in the case. Williams said found no merit to the arguments. The thrust of Phillips' defense was to suggest that Klein's ex-wife, Dr. Zipporah Katz, had somehow orchestrated the remote planting of the child porn videos on Klein's computer without his knowledge. Forensic computer examiners from the Louisiana State Police and the Louisiana Department of Justice testified there was no evidence that Klein's computer had been hacked, but did say the videos had been accessed and viewed only days before Klein's apartment was raided. The trial marked the first time in District Attorney Leon Cannizzaro's tenure of 8+ years that his prosecutor showed child pornography to a New Orleans judge or jury. Jurors viewed nearly 35 minutes of the contraband as prosecutors played 2 to 3 minute increments from each of the 20 illicit videos found on Klein's computer. Cannizzaro said, quote, juries, especially in the criminal court, don't ever really know what exactly they will be presented with. This was a case in which they were subjected to some very disturbing matter. Kenny Klein has been shown all sorts of support and derision, and according to the judge, it seems to have been in equal measure since his incarceration in 2014. The article that I originally wrote on this is the most read article ever on incitingariot.com, and it also has the most commented comments section in the, what is it now, 8-9 year history of that website. The comments section of that particular post on Kenny Klein, should you want to read it, is filled with people that felt that they knew something, that said that they had personally experienced something in regards to Klein, that felt that festival organizers were in the know, or at least in the suspect of Klein, and yet they continued to invite him to events, and yet they continued to expose him to potential victims. And when I read things like this, and I think most people, when they read things like this, they think, why didn't you say something? Why didn't you stop him? Why did nobody do anything? And the problem is that Kenny Klein held a position of authority in this community. I personally had books by Kenny Klein. I am a big fan of fairy tales and folk tales and how they relate to magic. And I had a book by him on fairy tale magic. And I enjoyed it. And then I had to figure out what to do with that book in March of 2014, because I didn't want to support this person anymore. I didn't want this in my house. I didn't want to be tainted by his presence. And yet, our community continues to support people time and again that make deplorable comments, that do deplorable things. There is a spectrum of problematic pagan leaders in our community. Everything from folks like Kenny Klein all the way down to, I believe, you know, beloved friend of the show, and I adore her and she knows this, but there were problematic tone deaf statements made by Dorothy Morrison that were called out by people of color this past year as being racially insensitive and tone deaf in a time when these kinds of statements and this kind of visibility matters. You have folks like Z Budapest and Christian Day who seem to perennially incite a riot of their own. If you're on pagan social media, a story from September of 2014 has been circulating in which Christian Day stated to somebody, quote, "I hope your stalker has some fun with you. Bye bye now. Trust me, pudgy hovers around the upper surface of how deep my words can cut. You couldn't curse me if you tried. All of you and your keyboard warrior friends together wouldn't be able to make a dent in what I do. Oh, and by the way, if he rapes you, please call out my name while he does. Cheerio." Christian was called out on these statements, and he later went on to make a $3,000 contribution to RAIN, which is a rape survivor assistance network. But it doesn't change the fact that folks like Day, folks like Z Budapest, who has made incalculable comments ridiculing everything from gay men to trans women to trans people in general, to comments stating that any time that you have sex with a man, it's rape. We have problematic pagan leaders that are propped up in our community and allowed to thrive because we are a very small community. And in my opinion, when this is my show, so I get to have the opinion, I think that we continue to allow these people support and visibility and access to our community and our dollars because we don't have many big names. We don't have many people willing to put themselves into the spotlight of pagan leadership and pagan celebrity for what it's worth. So we hold on to them for dear life. We rally around them. At times it reminds me of the police force. The police is called the Blue Curtain. I learned that in my first semester of Criminology 101, back when I was getting my first undergrad degree. Criminology 101 tells us that there is a blue curtain of crime, that if something happens inside of the police force, the police will surround them. And it doesn't really matter guilt or innocence, but we will absolutely protect our own. We will continue to support them. We will continue to make sure that they are well, completely disregarding whether or not there is a victim, whether or not the victim needs assistance, whether or not the actual offender did anything wrong. And yes, we have a spectrum of problematic leaders. We have leaders that spout off at the mouth. We have leaders that make disgusting comments about women, about rape. We have leaders that are tone deaf to the politics of the world. And we have leaders that will actually sexually abuse children. And they are all given a pass because we need leaders. Because the good folks don't get enough press. Because the good folks aren't getting enough attention. And I think that as the pagan community continues to move forward, we need to decide what we are going to do as a community with folks like this. We need to decide whether or not we are going to, with the next generation of leaders, tolerate people that make these kinds of statements, that do these kinds of things. Kenny Klein has so many supporters in the country and around the world. So many people that are absolutely willing to do mental gymnastics to believe the best about him. To believe that somebody must have set him up. So willing are we to write the comments off of people as jokes, of people as tone deaf, of our leaders that at one time, like Z Budapest was, who launched our community positively forward, who did a lot of wonderful things for women, for minorities in this community, and now have become incredibly problematic. have become incredibly divisive. I wrote an article last year, We Need to Talk About Asatru, because so many leaders in that community are so very racist. So much of Nordic Reconstructionism these days is marred and mired in racism and xenophobia. And we don't really want to talk about it much because we don't have much of a community as it is. We're very tiny. We're very mighty, but we're very tiny. And I think the reason that we allow this kind of thing to occur is that, one, there's not really much of an infrastructure to stop it. There's no one governing body that we can go to say, you get out of here. When these 2014 comments started recirculating on social media this past week, somebody made a ridiculous petition to excoriate, to shun Christian Day from the pagan community as though that was going to do anything. As though that's the way that you handle these things in 2017. But we do need to talk about our leaders. And we need to decide how much more we are willing to tolerate. And how, in the future, we plan on combating problematic pagan leaders. Every community needs leaders, but I'm not sure we need leadership like this. If you're a pagan community organizer, if you organize a pagan pride day, if you have a venue where you invite leaders, authors, speakers, teachers to come, maybe do a little bit of digging on who these people are. And maybe, and I understand that there are not a lot of pagan dollars to go around. I get it. Believe me. Believe me. As somebody that runs an independent media organization, I get it. There are not a lot of pagan dollars to go around. And it's a lot easier at times to bring in a name despite the problematic issues surrounding that name. Everybody from the Farrars to Klein to, you know, the list goes on of people that have been continued to be given an audience and a life, a living, because they had a name and shops, communities, venues, pagan pride days, wanted to get a name there, to get the word out, to get promotion, to get press, and to get those pagan dollars and to continue to do good work, to do real work, to build our community. But I encourage you, leaders, organizers, it might be worth it to get good folks, to get non-problematic folks in. I think our community is ready to support people that do good work, that build community, rather than leech off of it. Rather than, I wrote a book 20 years ago, I run a radio show now, I've got the most famous shop in Salem, I've got the most famous shop in New Orleans, I paved the way for Fairy Wicca, you know, whatever it is that's your thing that keeps you in the pagan circuit, maybe that's not worth it anymore, is all I'm saying. Maybe we put our dollars behind new pagan leaders. The problem is finding them and building them up and showing them that we as a community will support them. We like the old. We're good with the old. We're good with tried and true. It's difficult to find new folks that are willing to be a professional pagan. It's not a lucrative business. It's difficult. It's hard. But I think we're ready to support some good folks.
Inciting a helpful riot.
I listen to a lot of NPR, and one of my favorite people on the NPR Politics podcast and the NPR radio programs in general, the news programs, is Ron Elving, editor-correspondent. He's been around the public radio news circuit for decades and has more experience than, well, most people in the realm of politics and Congress and how laws are made and how politics is fought and won and how rights are won and lost and all that kind of thing. He's got perspective. And there's a word that he uses and has used a lot here in the last year that has really made me perk up and pay attention. And the word is catastrophizing. Catastrophizing is exactly like what it sounds like. It means to turn an event into a catastrophe. Oh, Donald Trump tweeted out something about North Korea. So therefore, we are going to World War III and we are all going to die. That is catastrophizing. It is not putting an event into the proper context. We are all guilty of catastrophizing. I am guilty of catastrophizing. But being made aware of the reality of catastrophizing has really made me wake up to the reality of catastrophizing and trying to find ways to combat it in my own life. It's not good for anybody's mental or physical health, especially anybody with any kind of stress or anxiety issues at all. Increased stress levels are known to cause all sorts of problems for the human body, and catastrophizing only leads to highly increased stress levels for the average person. So what I wanted to do today is very quickly go over 7 tips that I had for you guys to help you to stop catastrophizing in your own life, to help you perhaps gain a little bit more perspective over day-to-day events. One of the reasons why every single episode of Inciting a Riot for 109 episodes in has always started off with news headlines as much as possible is because I want to make sure that everybody is understanding the issues at hand with not only the facts of the matter, but how they relate to you as a person, as a specific individual living wherever you live. You know, catastrophizing here in the last year has meant things like, again, Donald Trump tweets a tweet. Hillary Clinton loses the election. Hillary Clinton has an email scandal. The North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un said X. Angela Merkel, the German chancellor, said Y. You see a news story about pollution or oil or global warming or something like that. And instantly, this is a big problem on both the left and the right. We catastrophize it. We act as though it is the biggest catastrophe ever and we are all about to die. Not only is that wrong, as we're all still here, it's not putting the event into the proper perspective, and it also increases your stress for no good reason. So here are some ways that I have found personally that help me with catastrophizing, and I hope that they help you. The first thing is I would like you to turn off the news. Please. I don't mean don't take in news. I mean stop watching news on TV if you can. I, at one point, was watching 5 or 6 news programs a day. You know, I was watching Anderson Cooper. I was watching Rachel Maddow. I was watching, probably, like I said, 6 news programs a day. And the problem with watching the news is that they have to do a lot of sensationalizing to keep your attention, or at least they think they do. There's these big, brash, bold headlines. You know, Ellen DeGeneres used to have a joke about, oh, will these Brussels sprouts kill you? More on that tonight at 11. You know, the headlines have to be the most controversial. They have to be the most engaging. They have to inspire you to keep watching, because if you don't keep watching, you might miss the one factoid about how we're all about to die. Stop watching the news on TV for a little while, at least. I would recommend listening to the news if you can. Listen to the facts of the matter. Stop being distracted by the videos that you see, by the guests, by the graphics even, by the headlines, by the jokes that folks have to make, again, to keep you engaged with continuing to watch day in and day out. And I would recommend listening to it. NPR, National Public Radio, puts out several wonderful podcasts. The NPR Politics podcast is great. Up First is wonderful. You now have an app, the NPR One app, where you can download and just listen to facts just facts, just exactly what's happening. Not a lot of pontificating, not a lot of editorializing, just facts and measured analysis of those facts, given the perspective of people that have been doing this for decades. And okay, well, this is bad, but not quite as bad as that thing that happened 12 years ago, and definitely not bad as that thing that happened 35 years ago. This is not normal, but this is not bad. Something not being normal isn't a catastrophe. Something being atypical isn't a catastrophe. Even something being criminal isn't necessarily a catastrophe. And I think that something that has made a big difference for me and my stress levels is turning off the TV for the most part when it comes to the news and listening to it instead. Give those same hours to the news, but listen to them if you can. And if you can stomach it, if you have the time and the ability, I would recommend reading the news if you can, because it will slow down your pace of intake to a level at which you can process the information at your own speed and take in the facts. You can make notes and you can do your own research later. So I would recommend highly, highly, highly turn the TV off for a while. Give yourself a couple months of TV news break. Listen to your news instead and read it if you can. Tip number two, develop healthy mind and body routines. Routines is key here. A routine, and this is going to be sort of something that comes up a couple of times in this list, but a routine helps to establish your reality. A lot of experts in lifestyle coaching and in psychology will tell you that routines help you feel a sense of security, a sense of safety. You know, when I wake up, I'm going to go to the gym. I'm going to get that little endorphin rush of exercise. And I know, you know, it helps you to plan your day. If you know, at least for the most part, what tomorrow is going to look like, you're less afraid of going into tomorrow. You're less likely to be fearful, to catastrophize the possible events of tomorrow, if you can have a bit of a routine. It doesn't have to be going to the gym, but I would recommend finding something that helps you to develop your body and mind, something that you consider exercise. Is it playing the piano? Is it going for a jog? Is it taking the dog for a walk in the morning and in the afternoon if you don't normally walk your dog, or you have a tiny little wildebeest, pocket-sized wildebeest like I do, that doesn't really need to be walked, but you probably should just to get some time outdoors. Whatever it is, if you are driving to work but it's walkable, maybe walk that. Give yourself some time to have a healthy mind and body routine if you can. Tip number three, be a part of your community. And this goes back to a topic that we have been talking about ever since the riot started. In-group, out-group dynamics. The more that you interact with other kinds of people than your tribe, the more likely that you are to humanize those people. One of the big problems that we have with racism and xenophobia is that we do not know our neighbors and we do not know them intimately. We do not see them as people. White Christians in Middle America don't have a lot of exposure to Muslims, to immigrants. And because of that, they do not humanize them. I encourage you to find a way to be a part of your community. If your community has, some kind of group thing, group outing around, I don't know, the 4th of July, some big community picnic or something like that, be a part of it, organize it. But here at the pagan level, you can possibly be a part of helping to organize your next pagan pride day. If there isn't one in your area, maybe you could be the person to help organize it. But do something to get different kinds of people, different races, different body types, different ethnicities, different genders, different backgrounds, different religions, lack of religion, together and meet them. If doing a big giant event is too much, maybe join a book club, join some kind of club, join something that has an open enrollment, open membership that you can be a part of, that you enjoy, and get to know other kinds of people on a one-on-one basis. Being a part of your community is one of the biggest acts of protest that you can do, because it will help you to learn your community, to see the needs and issues of other tribes, and make them your own and get involved with issues that you might not have realized were problematic in your community. It might sound simplistic or idealistic, but yeah, as something as simple as being a part of a local game night or a local book club or a local knitting circle can be incredibly helpful to bridge gaps in community. Number four, find a creative outlet. I don't care if you don't think that you're artistic. I don't care if you don't think you have a good voice. I don't care if you think that, you know, the creative arts aren't for you. Find some way to creatively express yourself. I know that for me, I have several creative outlets, this podcast being one of them, but I draw and I paint and I write and I do a lot of things that I consider to be creative outlets, and they are incredibly, incredibly helpful to me during times when it feels like the world is falling apart, when I do not recognize my state, my community, my country, my planet. I can turn to those creative endeavors and they will always catch me. They will always be there. And even if the art that I create isn't good art, it's expressive art. It gets the emotion out of my body and onto paper, onto canvas, onto clay, onto something. Even if I need to go into my closet and like sing, the only thing that comes out is, I don't know, lyrics from Wicked. You need that release. So find something. I don't really care what it is. It doesn't have to be good. It doesn't have to be something that you sell. It doesn't have to be museum quality art. It doesn't have to mean that you're eventually going to sing in front of some venue or something like that. But find something that you can enjoy that helps to get the emotion out of your body. Because at times of catastrophe, at times of catastrophizing, it can feel like there is a physical organ that has grown inside of you and you need to exorcise it. You need to get it out. You need to remove it creatively and surgically from your body and stick it on the page so that you don't have to carry around that tumor anymore. And believe me, I get that. I get that so hard. I grok it. I mean, I pass that on to you. Find something that is creative that you can do. Watch an old TV show. This is kind of hearkening back to that healthy routines. There was a study that came out, and I think around the time that Friends was getting a reboot on Netflix, that stated that watching old TV shows is a kind of therapeutic exercise, because if it's a show that you know and you know well, you know what's going to happen. You know the events that are going to happen. You know when you're about to laugh. You know when you're about to cry. And something about that sense of going home, sense of revisiting an old familiar place is very calming, because you know the events ahead of you. It is less scary almost, but it has a very calming effect on the psyche to watch a familiar TV show. So maybe have yourself a Buffy marathon, a Friends reunion. Go get all of the Hayao Miyazaki films and have all of your friends over for a pajama party and watch some old movies, watch some old TV shows. But get a long TV series that has several seasons and maybe pop some on when it's crazy out there in the world. It literally has a clinically proven therapeutic effect on your mind. Take a free university course. Places like Harvard offer courses, so to speak, that you can audit online for free. iTunes University has a ton of, you know, hundreds, thousands of hours of lectures that you can take for free and do this coursework for free in your own time. Expanding your mind, expanding your knowledge base will help you in times of catastrophe, because it will help you to get perspective. It will give you the knowledge base to, you know, if you're taking a bio course or a chem course or something like that, and you hear about global warming, it will help you put the facts of that particular news story into perspective. It will help you to filter out the catastrophizing of it and only focus on the facts. and it will give you a better understanding of those facts, because then you cannot catastrophize because you do not know what is actually going on. You do not know the words. You cannot pretend that, oh gosh, these vaccines are going to give my child autism because you don't know how to pronounce the ingredients. You're not going to be so scared of what happened politically if you've been taking a U.S. history course and you know the history of this country and what other kinds of events, what other presidents have done, what other leaders have done, what other wars we've been in, and you have that sense of perspective. So maybe take a sociology course, maybe take a U.S. history course, maybe take a religion course. But expanding your mind, expanding your knowledge base will help you to find academic perspective, and that will decrease your likelihood of catastrophizing an event. Finally, seek a sounding board. Seek somebody that you feel has a very level head, that will listen to you and let you freak out, and then will bring you back to reality, because we all need those people. I need those people. And I have am blessed, thankfully, with so many people that act as that sounding board for me. I have a group of people that I message. I have friends that we get together a couple of times a week and just sort of vent about the news, about how we've been feeling about it, about, you know, what today's news has wrought and how we're feeling about that. It helps to not catastrophize because you have somebody with a level head to bring you back to reality. And if that person needs to be somebody that you pay, great. You know, if you are privileged enough to have, you know, the kind of health insurance where you can go to seek professional counseling, go there. Do it. There is absolutely no shame in that. Find somebody that can be that non-biased sounding board for you, somebody that will have your best interests at heart. So those are my tips, my 7 tips for not catastrophizing. If you have any tips on catastrophizing, write into the show.
Inciting a spiritual riot.
Finally today, I would like to talk about spiritual protest. You might remember this past February, just a couple of months ago, there was a Donald Trump hex that was going around. It was a binding spell that was supposed to bind Donald Trump from doing harm, as well as all of those that abet him. This is unlike other witchy forms of protest, like the aforementioned Mr. Day used a few years ago in protesting Charlie Sheen. This was used to actually create a form of political protest, of political action. And I wasn't going to participate. I don't know. Part of me thought it was silly. Part of me thought it was ineffectual. And I just, at the end of the day, was like, I'm not going to get involved. This seems like something that I don't want to do. I don't really know why somebody who has created a blog and podcast called Inciting a Riot thought that a form of magical protest was not a thing to do. It was not a good use of his time. But there you have it. But I ended up doing it, and I ended up doing it because of my husband. My husband found out about the spiritual protest, so to speak, and looked at me and said, so we're doing this, right? And he wanted to do it not because he's this incredibly witchy person, but because he was angry, because he was upset, because he was afraid, because he wanted to feel like he was taking action of some kind. And on February 24th of 2017, people all over, honestly, regardless of spiritual persuasion, were taking action, were participating in spiritual protest. At least that's what I'm going to call it. Some people called it cursing, some people called it hexing, some people just straight up called it the binding that it was. But choosing to refer to it as spiritual protest. Do I think that the mass movement of people that are binding Donald Trump have resulted in anything concrete? I don't know. And to be perfectly honest, I'm not really sure that that was even the point. I think that the point was to feel as though that we in the spiritual community were doing something, we're taking some kind of action. I was watching all sorts of videos after the fact of people from all walks of life, people that were Christians, people that were atheists, people of all sorts of ethnic and racial and spiritual backgrounds were taking place, were participating publicly in public venues, were joining groups of people in spiritual warfare, spiritual protest against this person who they feel, and I would agree with them, is a direct threat to much of what we consider sacred in this country and around the world, because the President of the United States has a lot of say and sway in the kinds of liberties that are garnered by all sorts of minorities around the world. Whether or not our president stands up for the rights of LGBTQ citizens in a place like Chechnya carries a lot of weight, and the fact that he's not doing anything does have a measured effect. And so I think that I decided to participate because I was so inspired by my husband's anger and by my husband's fear. You know, I always think about Alanis Morissette talking about, you know, whether or not she should keep making angry music. And she talks about how anger is a beautiful emotion. And that when you work through the anger to create art, when you work through the anger to create anything, that it can be just as beautiful as writing a love song. And I think that that was a lesson that I had to give to myself, that I had to learn for myself this year, that there was a level of psychological catharsis that was gained from doing this protest. Now, I didn't participate in the same way that everybody else did. There was a Facebook group going around and blog posts going around depicting, you know, this sort of, I don't know if you want to call it bland, but this sort of blanket open source binding ritual that you could use and adapt to your own needs. I didn't do that. My friends and I, Vinna Harper, the literary maven here and sometimes book reviewer who joins me from time to time here on the show, we got together along with my husband. And how we did this protest was we got some white cloth. We cut it into a puppet shape, a human shape. We colored it up to sort of look like Donald Trump in a suit with penis exposed, because it was funny. And we sewed it up. My husband did the sewing because, you know, as a surgeon, he's the best stitcher out of all of us. And then we took to writing notes. We would put either a word or several sentences on small pieces of paper and wrap them up and stuff them into this poppet. And they were things that, you know, they were words of power to us. They were ways that the president has made us feel afraid. They were feelings that we were feeling about the current political and social climate. They were actual quotes that he has said, actual actions that he and his compatriots have taken. The ways that we feared for our future, the ways that we would celebrate change when it eventually comes, our hopes, our fears, our dreams, our felicitations, our solicitations to whoever might be listening during this magical moment. We wrote them all down and we stuffed the poppet with them and then sewed the poppet all the way up. And then we stuck pins in it with how we, as we were speaking, the kind of change that we wanted, the kind of action that we wished to take. And then we burned it. And then my husband took the ashes to the bathroom and threw them in the toilet and, well, defecated on them and flushed them down the toilet. Because that's what felt right to us in that moment. And I think that it woke me up to the idea that this craft that we have and practice can be something political, can be something powerful, that it can be a form of protest, that you can work for positive change in your life, and you can aim that spiritual arrow at those in power. And there were a lot of BNP big name pagan folks that were coming out of the woodworks, because I feel like there are authors that just wait for a hint of the word curse or hex to be around the blogosphere of the pagan community so that they can come out and remind us all that that's dark magic and we don't do dark magic and we should be doing love and light and inject nothing but goodness into the world because, oh my gosh, we're not those bad, bad, dirty, dirty witches giving us all a bad name. Listen, if doing some kind of spiritual protest is giving us a bad name, then oh buddy, oh man, I fear for those people, because what kind of sheltered, privileged lives do you lead where actions like this, we're trying to spiritually force somebody out of power to bind them from doing harm, is something to be shied away from, is seen as something dark and evil and the kind of working that we should shun. What kind of privilege must you have to not see the need for that form of spiritual protest? What kind of sheltered life must you live to not see how people are hurting and fearful and dying right now, and to not want to work against that with whatever spiritual tools you have at your disposal? When we were done, it felt good. It felt like release. It felt like protest, and it felt holy. And I don't care if it worked. I don't care if Donald Trump woke up with a headache the next day from all of the spiritual energy sent his way. I don't really care, because I know how it felt to get that out of me. Sort of earlier when I was talking about catastrophizing and needing that creative outlet to exorcise, excreate that thing from inside of you. It felt like the thing that we needed to do. And it felt like something I plan on doing a whole heck of a lot more going forward. I don't plan on excusing my spiritual practice from my political practice. I don't plan on excusing my religious path, my relationship with the divine, from my relationship with this world. I think inciting a riot is all about marrying your spiritual path, your religious path, your connection with divinity, with action here on the ground. If you believe that climate change is a problem, why would you not engage not only your physical self, but your spiritual self to enact change? Why would you not target companies both spiritually and in physical forms of protest that you felt were doing harm to your planet, irreparable harm for generations to come? Why would you not target spiritually the politicians that are enacting laws in North Carolina that make being transgender a crime? Why would you not take a look at what spiritual working you can do to make sure that Black people in this country are not afraid to be Black in this country? Why would you excuse your altar from the fight? Why would you not engage spiritually with the issues that are important to you, unless you don't trust your own craft? Unless you think it's crap on some level. Because hiding behind this idea of, oh, it's dark, oh gosh, we don't work negativity, how the hell is working against racism and poverty and climate change, global warming, xenophobia, homophobia, how is that working negativity into this world in a spiritual fashion? Please do tell me. I encourage you, write to me. I will read those emails. Because as for me and my craft, this was a wake-up call to the catharsis and amazing power that is accessed by taking that fear, taking that anger, and using that as energy for positive work towards the things that are important to me, towards protecting myself, my family, and my loved ones, towards making sure that the next generation is less fearful than mine, towards making sure that the next generation feels more secure and doesn't have to worry as much about coming out as gay, doesn't have to worry as much about being a racial minority, doesn't have to worry about whether or not their clothing choices are going to incite some redneck somewhere into violence because they don't understand that the head covering that that man or woman is wearing isn't an act of war. I am no longer going to excuse my spiritual path from my political path. I am no longer going to excuse the work that I do at my altar from the work that I do at the voting booth. And I encourage you, anybody listening to this podcast, to do the same. It was incredible. It was incredible. And I encourage you, if what you hear on the news scares you, do some work at the altar. Do some work with the gods of your understanding. Work whatever you have to work to make you feel better, to make you feel safer, to make you feel better about the safety and security of your loved ones. And damn anybody who would say anything against that. Who the hell cares? Who the hell are they? Trying to hold on to some kind of apologetic nonsense from the satanic panic of the, what, 80s? My God. That was 3 decades ago. It's 2017. Stop apologizing for your craft. And start using it. Start using it to make meaningful change. Because if you're not going to use it for that, what the hell are you using it for? This was a brilliant experience for me, and I hope that more are organized. And even if more aren't mass organized, I'll probably just continue to do them. Who the hell knows? Maybe it'll be my new full moon tradition. Curse the president. Hail the gods. Hail the gods. Curse the president. Curse whatever politician is currently trying to instill fear just because somebody wants to go pee. Curse the politician that is allowing countries to create concentration camps where we lock up people just for existing, just for maybe existing. Because if you're not going to use it for that, what are you using it for? What is so important? I encourage you to write in. Firelight, F-I-R-E-L-Y-T-E, at incitingariot.com. I'd love to hear, did you participate in the Trump hex? Did you participate? Have you ever participated in any kind of magical protest? If so, write in. Let me know. I'd love to hear about your experience. Speaking of writing in, we've gotten some emails since we last spoke, and I'd love to read a few.
Inciting your riot.
Listener, new listener, Josette, wrote in, and Josette said, "Hello, Firelight. I have recently begun listening to your podcast. I was introduced to your show through New World Witchery, who mentioned you a few times." Aw, thanks, guys. "I heard an episode with you and Corey having a discussion about the girls who brutally attacked a friend in honor of Slenderman, which was a phenomenal episode. I just wanted to let you know that you're brilliant. I love listening to you. You are insightful and knowledgeable, as well as humorous. I sometimes begin a segment of your show not sure if I agree with your opinion, but most times you'll make me see things from a different perspective. And if by the end of the show I still don't agree with you, I have the utmost respect for your insight, because it's so obvious that you put a great deal of thought and research into everything you do. I love your brutal honesty and the passion you put into all you do. Please keep staying true to yourself. Sending much love and blessings, Josette." Thank you so much, Josette. I'm so glad that the passion that I have for these topics comes through. And I don't want you to agree with me. Absolutely, I do not want you to agree with me. I want you to challenge your own thinking. And if in doing so, you end up seeing things my way, great. But even if you don't, the fact that you took a second to think about why you disagree with me and you did research to back that up is the point of this show. I advocate good research, and anybody that's going to take something from this show and go out and do further research and find good sources, find better ideas, that's amazing. From iTunes, and I did want to go through and read some of the recent, most recent iTunes comments, just because I haven't read those in a while. And I just wanted to say thank you guys so much for continuing to keep it in pretty much five stars after, my gosh, this show started in 2009 and it's 2017. So, 8 years in, and we're still, sitting pretty at 4.5, almost five stars, with 94 out of 109 ratings being five stars. So thank you guys so much for continuing to rate the show so highly. If you haven't done so, I will be reading the iTunes comments here on the show. So if you want to get on the show, putting an iTunes comment, taking the time to do that is a great way to get on the show. Sikulski A said, awesome podcast, keep being awesome. Thank you so much. I will try. Rev Desi said, I stumbled across Firelight on his 99th episode. I found the conversation intriguing and offering a different perspective from my own. I've gone back since and listened to a lot of the older episodes. Great podcast and would definitely recommend. Rev does say that the transitions are a lot louder than the conversation, and that's why this person gave us 4 stars. So I hope that the volume levels have been improved. Brojo wrote in and said, the show is well edited, follows a fairly consistent flow and planned formula, now lasting through 100 episodes, covering a vast range of topics from the academic to news stories and activist topics. When the host plays devil's advocate, it really helps the target audience scrutinize any of their own beliefs, which they might be taking for granted. And lastly, Eben Rose, Firelight does excellent research on all of his chosen topics and also interviews guests with an open mind while not shying away from challenging questions. His show is always educating and illuminating. I highly recommend it. Thank you guys so much. If you would like to also submit your own commentary, there are lots of ways that you can get in touch with the show and lots of ways that I encourage you to do so. You can tweet me. I am at Inciting a Riot on Twitter. This show does have a Facebook page, facebook.com/Inciting a Riot Podcast. Please like the show on Facebook, as I do post there from time to time, including show notes as well as stories and updates on ongoing stories that will probably eventually make it to either the blog or podcast. I know that I was keeping up sort of with the ongoing issues around the recent Kenny Klein events on the Inciting a Riot Facebook page, and that was a great way to sort of share up-to-the-minute information. You can also, of course, keep up with the blog at incitingariot.com. I've been trying to post there a little bit more frequently. A few of the recent additions to the blog have been pretty well received. So thank you guys for continuing to read after all of this time. Of course, you can like, rate, and subscribe to the show on iTunes or wherever you happen to get podcasts. iTunes is also a great way. If you do give a rating, it does help to keep this show up in the ratings so that other folks can find it. So please, if you have not already rated the show, please head over to iTunes and do so. I thank you so much for that. Also, please do remember that this show, just like Inciting a Brouhaha, my sister show with Velma Nightshade, co-hosted with Velma Nightshade, is a Patreon-supported podcast. There is a new URL, and several of you folks have already gone there and let myself and Velma know how much you appreciate our continued work on our respective podcasts by donating a few bucks a month to help us make sure that the monthly fees are paid for, that software can continue to be updated. And who knows, as more money comes in, the more that we'll be able to eventually do for you guys. The URL is patreon.com/incitingprojects. That covers both Inciting a Riot and Inciting a Brouhaha. It's Patreon, patreon.com/incitingprojects. If you'd like, there are donation levels as little as $5 a month. You can give $1 a month. That gets you all sorts of things. It gets you early news about any events that we may be doing, any upcoming super secret interviews, invites to the show possibly that we might be doing, as well as for listeners of Inciting a Brouhaha, you might like at some levels, you will be getting a full unedited audio version of my joint podcast with Velma. There's, you know, 10, 20, 30 minutes at times of extra audio that doesn't make it to the show. For folks that are donors to Inciting Projects, they will get that audio as a special thank you. Going forward, Velma and I are going to start doing video recordings, and those video podcasts will also be available to certain levels of Patreon subscribers. So if you would like to see Velma and I in all of our video glory with all of the looks and the shade that we throw at one another, the notes that we write to each other, and the hand gestures we make, please do consider giving a slightly larger donation at patreon.com/incitingproject. So thank you so much to everybody who has already donated and anybody who is thinking of doing so for supporting independent pagan media. That is all for me. I do want to specifically mention the next show that I plan on doing is going to be another roundtable. This next roundtable, I'm going to open it up to you to write in and let me know whether or not you'd like to be a part of it. The next roundtable is going to be about body politics. I would like to talk about fat shaming, thin shaming, race in this country, hair, size, color, gender. I want to have a big, round, fat discussion about size, about bodies, about how our bodies are politicized in this country. Whether you're a man, whether you're a woman, whether you're non-gender conforming, your race, your ethnicity, your creed, your religion, your color, all of it. I would like to speak to as many people as possible and get as large a round table as needs to exist for this conversation to happen. It will be broken up into as many parts as needs to be, and the conversation will go as long as it has to be. Because I want us to have an exhaustive discussion about the way that we politicize bodies and body parts in this country. And I invite you, the rioters, on to discuss those kinds of things. So feel free to write into the show, Firelight, F-I-R-E-L-Y-T-E, at incitingariot.com. Let me know if you would like to be part of this show. I will be taking volunteers. I also have some folks in mind, some folks that have already been on the show and folks that I have been wanting to have on the show for a long time that have already very graciously agreed to be on the show for this particular discussion. And I think you will want to be on that round table because there are some very familiar and very big names that have already said yes to that. So I'm super excited around the next body politics riot. But that is it for this riot. Thank you so much for sticking around for this inciting a protest riot. I do appreciate it. And I'm going to have to go, but I promise to leave you, as always, with love and light, Firelight.